Well, good afternoon. Thank you for being here. The microphone is on. So I guess first programming note, in accordance with Harvard Law School policies, I have to announce to you that this event is being recorded. And that is also why I'm using this microphone, because many people do say that my voice requires lots of amplification to be heard. My name is Ben Fonz. I'm the president of the Harvard Federal Society. The Federal Society is a group of conservative libertarian lawyers and law students that stands for three main principles: the state exists to preserve freedom, the separation of powers is central to our Constitution, and that it's a fact of the province and duty of the judiciary to say what the law is and not what it should be. Just two programming notes today. I want to extend a special welcome to one else who have reached the final day of fall semester. Congratulations to you. Thanks for being here. Also wanted to highlight, many of you by now are probably aware, that Professor Charles Freed, who has served as the Harvard Federal Society's advisor for the last 40 years, announced his retirement yesterday. And he has been teaching at this law school since 1961, probably the longest tenure that anyone will ever have teaching at this law school, given that he started at the ripe old age of 25. So I spoke with him yesterday. He is as joyous as ever, and we're thrilled that he served as our advisor for this period of time. With that, I'm going to turn things over to our Vice President of Speakers, Brecken Dillard, to introduce today's topic, Anna.
Thanks, Ben, and thanks to all of you. With looming finals taking an hour to talk about a very important topic, and to remember an important speech in American history. So we are gathered here today to remember Frederick Douglass's 1860 speech, A Plea for Free Speech in Boston, and to reflect on the state of free speech here in the country and the world. And to do this, we're thrilled to be joined by two preeminent experts in the world of free speech and the law. I'll begin by introducing Professor Damian Strassen, who is a global preeminent expert on free speech issues and former president of the ACLU. She is the John Marshall Harlan II Professor of Law Emeritus in New York Law School. She's a senior fellow at FIRE, and affiliated with a number of other organizations. She's a recipient of many awards and has written a number of books on free speech topics. She's a graduate of Harvard College and this law school, and we are very glad to have her joining us today. And sitting next to her is Professor Randall Kennedy, who is no stranger to us here. He is the Michael R. Pine Professor of Law here at Harvard Law School. Also a preeminent expert on speech issues, he's an expert on race and the law and contract law. Professor Kennedy is a graduate of Princeton, Oxford, and Yale Law School. After law school, he clerked for Justice J. Scalia Wright and Judge J. Scalia Wright and Justice Thurgood Marshall. And he's also the author of a number of books on race issues and free speech. And we're very glad to have them both join us today to talk about this important topic. Please join me in welcoming them, and we look forward to the remarks.
Thank you so much. Randy and I are old friends and colleagues and have spoken at many Federal Society events, among other things. And what we most enjoy doing is having a conversation between friends who share many of the same commitments. We have some disagreements and some arguments. But I asked if I could start because I wanted to thank Randy for spending his precious time here with us. And with me again, I want to thank the Federal Society, including Ben and Brecken, for their great work in organizing this. And I can't resist saying what I say every time I hear or read the Federal Society mission statement, that the state exists to preserve freedom. To me, that sounds like it comes straight out of the ACLU playbook. So I always like to find commonalities. And in fact, I once made that observation many years ago to one of the preeminent founders of the Federal Society, and this was at a public event, and he got very exercised, and it's actually in print, it was published, maybe even in the Harvard Journal of Public Policy, and he said, Ms. Strassen seems to have found this statement somewhere. If it ever existed, I hope the Federalist Society has repealed it. And so every time I speak to a FedSoc group, I always look to see if it's been repealed, and so far not yet.
You're still pro-freedom.
So Randy, you are such a phenomenal expert on racial justice and history, and you've written so powerfully and beautifully, and your magnum opus on topics still to come. Can you set the historic context and basic facts about the speech whose anniversary we're commemorating?
Happy to do so. So we are commemorating Frederick Douglass's speech, Free Speech in Boston, December 10, 1860. What prompted him to give this speech is that he was speaking downtown in Boston, and there was an abolitionist gathering. And in fact, the topic was, how shall slavery be abolished? And the gathering was broken up by people who were anti-abolitionists. It was broken up. Douglass and his fellow abolitionists had asked the mayor of Boston to provide protection, and the mayor of Boston did not. And Douglass was manhandled at the setting, and he couldn't speak. And so he thought it was very important to come back. And so a week later, he comes back to the same place, and he gives this speech, Free Speech in Boston. And of course, Douglass was one of the great orators of the 19th century. And there were a number of abolitionists who were great orators. Wendell Phillips, for instance, graduate of his law school, was one of his colleagues, one of his close friends. And you know, freedom of speech was absolutely essential to the abolitionist cause. And so Douglass gives this talk in favor of free speech. And let me just read a couple of lines from it.
I know some of them by heart. I bet.
Liberty is meaningless where the right to utter one's thoughts and opinions has ceased to exist. That of all rights is the dread of tyrants. There can be no right of speech where any man, however lifted up or however humble, however young or however old, is overawed by force and compelled to suppress their honest sentiments. Equally clear, and this is something that you focus on a lot, equally clear is the right to hear. To suppress free speech is a double wrong. It violates the right of the hearer as well as those of the speaker. It is just as criminal to rob a man of his right to speak and hear as it is to rob him of his money. And then finally, the last line of the speech, a man's right to speak does not depend upon where he was born or upon his color. The simple quality of manhood is the solid basis of the right, and there let it rest forever. He published this in The Liberator, December 14, 1860. So that's Frederick Douglass, and Douglass throughout his life harped on the importance of freedom to speak, freedom to listen. That was a central feature of his thought.
Thank you to the Federalist Society for giving me the opportunity to reread it, because it's one of those classic documents that each time you read it, it resonates with new power and even new insights. The lines that, I mean, almost every word in it is eloquent, including the ones that you read. But the one that I often recite is one that really drives home the essential role that free speech plays in achieving or promoting equal rights, including racial justice. And conversely, what a powerful force censorship is in impeding equal rights, including racial justice. And here's the line that I think captures that just with unparalleled force. Slavery could not abide free speech. 5 years of its exercise would abolish the auction block and break every chain in the South. So, you know, today, not only today, but really starting in the 1980s, we started to hear a lot of arguments and a lot of law review articles that we have to choose between freedom of speech and equality, that somehow these two rights are mutually inconsistent. And I continue to believe, I say continue because I strive to be open-minded and to re-examine even the most deeply held thoughts, but I continue to believe, along with Douglas, that free speech is the essential engine for promoting these causes. And if I may, Randy, I made some notes about some other major themes that come out from this speech. You mentioned one, which is really important. And to the best of my knowledge, Douglas was the very first person to articulate the concept that was not recognized by the Supreme Court until the second half of the 20th century, that freedom of speech includes not only the right of the speaker to convey ideas and information, but also the right of the audience to receive ideas and information. And that is very powerful. It's a point that I find I have to make to my liberal friends who are supporting, for example, gagging of Donald Trump. And yes, you know, on a fact-specific basis, if a gag order is narrowly tailored and necessary to prevent injustice, to allow due process to proceed in courtrooms, that's fine. But we have to recall that what is at stake is not only the right of somebody who is a powerful political person to voice his views, including his critiques of the justice system, but the right of voters to hear that, including voters who disagree with what he's saying, but therefore want to know what he's saying. So Douglas was way ahead of his time in that respect. He was also way ahead of his time in another respect, Randy, which your quotes alluded to, and that is this notion that, you know, equality is intertwined with free speech in two ways. Number one, as I already commented, that free speech is necessary to promote equality, but also he articulated a concept of free speech that embodies equality in the field of speech, regardless of identity, who the speaker is, and regardless of ideas. Now, all of you who have taken constitutional law or free speech courses will recognize that what he's talking about in the second half of the 20th century, thanks to Thurgood Marshall, for whom Randy clerked, became enunciated by the Supreme Court as the bedrock principle of freedom of speech: content neutrality, viewpoint neutrality, and only a couple decades later, speaker neutrality. Government may not favor or disfavor speech based on these factors. And this was something that Douglas was so far ahead. So, you know, Randy, that brings me to, one other theme, which you alluded to in your opening factual remarks. Government's responsibility to protect the rights of the speaker and the audience against violence and against threatened violence. You know, it is just as important for meaningful free speech for government not to suppress speech that is constitutionally protected. It is equally important for government to punish expression and conduct that is not constitutionally protected, including intimidation and threats and intentional incitement of imminent violence and targeted harassment and hostile environment harassment, all of which we're seeing today or hearing reports of today in fairness on college campuses, including right here at Harvard. You know, if people feel afraid that they are going to be assaulted for voicing certain ideas, that is the fear is instilled by what the law calls a true threat, right, where the speaker targets an audience member and intends to instill an object of a reasonable fear that they will be subject to attack. The speaker doesn't have to even intend to carry out the attack. The mere fact that you have a reasonable fear already inhibits your own freedom of speech as well as your own freedom of movement. And in the Boston situation, it went beyond threatening speech. It was actually assaults. But I think we have to be very cognizant of the failure of government officials in this situation, and the failure of government officials, including on public campuses, university officials, to protect speech by punishing those who abuse their speech as well as engaging in violent conduct.
I think the one thing about Douglass's speech that's a bit unclear, so it's true that he says near the end, it's true that he says, he suggests that he would defend any person's speech, saying anything. Well, maybe, but he's giving this speech in 1860. The Civil War is about to begin. 3 years later, there did come a test. Because 3 years later, there were people of Abraham Lincoln. Abraham Lincoln issues an executive order saying that he's going to view anybody who gives aid and comfort to the Confederacy, that he's going to view them essentially as traitors. His generals tell people, if you speak on behalf of the Confederacy, we're going to court-martial you, we're going to subject you to military justice. This did come to pass. There were Democrats who did not like Lincoln's war policy, and some of them were arrested. And there were people who had to make a choice. Now, there were some pro-Lincoln folk, pro-abolition folk, who disagreed with Lincoln very openly. But then there were others who said, listen, you know, this is wartime, this is an emergency, and we're going to go with Lincoln. It's unclear to me, and I've looked. I have not seen Douglass pronounce on this. But frankly, I'm using that as a platform for a question for you. Because, I mean, if I had to choose, you've been involved in, you know, many controversies. But if somebody asked me, what has been the main controversy that you have had, that you have addressed through now several decades, it would be the question, it would be your position of defending your enemy. I mean, I know one of your heroes, Ari Nair, wrote a book with something like that, the title.
That was the title. Defending My Enemy.
Defending My Enemy. And so over and over, you have had to confront. So I know that, you know, when you were president of the ACLU, there was the controversy, Skokie, or, you know, is the ACLU really going to defend Nazis? And I know that for you, this was, I mean, for anyone, it's a major issue. But I would think that for you, it would be an especially telling issue since, am I right, that you have a parent who survived the death camps in Europe? So this was a real issue for you, and you were the head of the ACLU when the ACLU actually litigated on behalf of the Nazis. I was in law school, by the way, during that period and disagreed with the ACLU position, but that's a different issue.
Have you seen the light since then?
I have changed. I have changed. But there was that. There was that. There was, and
pornography.
I brought the Nadine Strossen Library with me. So you talk about that issue a lot in your book. The title tells us why hate, why we should resist it with free speech, not censorship, but that's a central thing. Then an earlier book, Defending Pornography, Free Speech, Sex, and the Fight for Women's Rights, in which you were really you know, gosh, you were really raked over the coals mm-hmm. by people who thought that, frankly, that you were a traitor mm-hmm. to your gender. Mm-hmm. And then more recently, I mean, just last week, in this publication, the Free Press, you co-authored an article, and the title tells the story. Even anti-Semites deserve free speech. So this has been a thing with you. Well, talk about it.
More importantly, Randy, it's been a thing with the Supreme Court, right? This is the viewpoint neutrality principle although it was not adopted by a majority of the court until the second half of the 20th century, its origins go back actually to the first Jewish justice on the Supreme Court, Louis Brandeis, who wrote a wonderful, it was technically a concurring opinion for technical reasons, but it reads like a dissent in a case called Whitney versus California, in which, by the way, the person whose free speech rights were being suppressed was a woman, and Brandeis said, fear of injury is not a justification for suppressing speech. Men feared witches and burned women. So, you know, as the strict scrutiny standard demands as a justification for limiting speech, you have to have not just a compelling purpose. It would be wonderful to eliminate or even reduce anti-Semitism or misogyny or violence. But the mere fact that the government has that as the asserted purpose of a restriction sensibly does not suffice to justify the restriction. The court also goes on to demand, does the restriction actually materially reduce the potentially problematic speech? And is it necessary and the least restrictive speech restrictive alternative for doing so? Or conversely, would a non-speech suppressive approach be even more effective? As Brandeis says in Whitney, the answer to bad counsels is good ones. What you're trying to suppress is an idea, an attitude, and certainly conduct, as I've already talked about, violent or discriminatory conduct. Suppressing words doesn't effectuate any of that. And again, let me hasten to add that even though I've been harping on this theme for many decades, I continue rigorously to read everything I can on point, the counter-arguments. You'll recognize in my newest book, Randy, the first substantive chapter is the 12 strongest arguments against free speech. You know, I've been answering tens of thousands of questions in the past, you know, 7 years, speaking constantly about free speech, and I really do try to grapple with them. And I also look extensively at the evidence of the many laws against hate speech and against sexual expression or so-called pornography, the stigmatizing term. And even when those laws have the best intentions, they predictably and consistently end up being completely ineffective in advancing their goals and quite arguably counterproductive to the extent that human rights advocates in countries all over the world have opposed hate speech laws, not because of the free speech guarantees in their own national laws or constitution, because those laws are consistent with their concept of free speech, but because they say it is not an effective way to deal with the actual problem. And in fact, many of them contend, and this is true for international human rights agencies and regional human rights agencies, as well as activists in many countries around the world, that disproportionately these laws end up suppressing the speech by and behalf of the very minority groups that were intended to be benefited by the laws. And that's not a coincidence. it goes back to what we saw with the abolitionists and with, you know, Douglas and other African Americans and advocates of their rights. By definition, when you lack majority power, either because your ideas are in a minority and or because you're part of an identity minority, the government is going to be responsive to those who wield majority power. And that's appropriate in a democracy, right? But when the government has sufficient latitude and discretion to determine such an inherently subjective, vague concept as hate speech or pornography, which the feminist that I was opposing as a free speech feminist, opposing the so-called radical feminist, their definition of illegal pornography was a type of hate speech. It was sexually explicit expression that is demeaning or degrading toward women. Not surprisingly, those concepts are wielded disproportionately against speech that advocates for reproductive freedom and for women's rights. And by the way, you know, the book is very old. It came out in 1995. Last year, NYU Press contacted me and asked me to republish the book as part of the NYU Classic series because, with a new preface, because as many of you may know, the P word, which everybody uses for whatever sexual expression they dislike, it's not a legal term of art, has been wielded by those who are banning books from public libraries, from school libraries, from curricula, that almost exclusively are books by and about LGBTQ plus authors, right? The P word is used to condemn them. And it's also been used to condemn expression by sex workers who are trying to organize for their safety and their equality. So I remain open-minded, Rain, but it's not difficult for me as the daughter of a Holocaust survivor, and Randy referred to Arye Nair, who was literally the national executive director of the ACLU when we defended freedom of speech for Nazis in Skopje. I wasn't yet the national president. I'm not that much older than you. I just graduated from law school. I was a baby lawyer and volunteer for the ACLU. And Arye was himself a Holocaust survivor. He was born in the early 1930s in Germany. His extended family was completely slaughtered by the Nazis. His immediate family escaped to this country. And he writes the most powerful explanation of why, as a Jew, it is especially important to have free speech on our side, because we are never going to have, you know, 2.4% of the population nationwide, 0.2% of the worldwide population. We can't depend on majority power any more than the abolitionists could.
I want to push you on that.
Yeah.
Because your defense is, as you said, a couple of you, an open mind. Mm-hmm. It is a provisional position.
Yes.
And it's largely a sociological position. You basically say, given the structure of society, it's most likely, mm-hmm. it's most likely that we'll have a better situation mm-hmm. without censorship. Mm-hmm. Now, you know, things do change. Mm-hmm. There are new technologies. Mm-hmm. So, for instance, in the 1930s, the great David Reisman, mm-hmm. for instance, was in favor
right.
of group defamation laws, precisely because, taking a look at Goebbels mm-hmm. and saying, "Gosh, you know, in the era of the radio, mm-hmm. don't we need some different calculations?"
Yeah.
Well, I ask you, in the era of new technology, I mean, frankly, a lot of these, I don't even know what the technologies are. I'm still, you know, I hear my kids talk about, you know, Instagram or something. But, you know, these new technologies, could you see yourself, is it plausible to think that in an era of new technologies, you might change your mind, that, you know, it may be the case that disinformation and technologies of propaganda become so powerful and can interact on and can affect masses of people so quickly that that becomes an emergency?
So Randy is alluding to what I and others, starting with Brandeis, have called the emergency standard, that basically our current law, which is supported by every justice across the all of the broad ideological disagreements that they have, they nonetheless support this concept that government may restrict speech if but only if the restriction is necessary to prevent an emergency, right? A tight, direct, causal connection between the speech and the harm. It's another way of describing the strict scrutiny concept. And it is, as with all other free speech standards, very context-specific, applied in light of all of the facts and circumstances. And certainly one of the major factors in my new book, I isolate a number of factors that the Supreme Court repeatedly considers in addressing whether a particular speech restriction is justified. And one of the factors is the means of communication. Each time a new means of communication comes before the Supreme Court, it evaluates the question whether the First Amendment applies. After all, it refers expressly only to speech and press, press being the only medium other than speech that existed at the time. And for example, when movies were first invented, the Supreme Court for several decades held, you know, not covered by the First Amendment. And that's why we have, even until my early childhood, you know, official film censorship boards that were not allowing certain films to be seen. When the internet sprang to the public and media and political attention, and had been known to scientists and engineers for a while, but it wasn't until the early 1990s that it came to public attention, and the immediate reaction was what we have seen throughout history, going back to Gutenberg and the printing press. Every time a new, powerful, cheaper communications medium comes along that makes it easier and faster to reach a larger audience, those of us who are human rights champions get very excited, and those who have a more authoritarian bent, or one, say, community-oriented bent, to be less stigmatizing, get very nervous about it, and nervous about potential dangers of speech that can be harmful. And when the internet came along, I tell this to my con law students every time I teach Reno versus ACLU, that case was not at all a foregone conclusion, even though the Supreme Court ended up deciding it essentially unanimously 9-0. It was the Clinton administration that opposed us. Janet Reno was his attorney general. That's where the name comes from. In Congress, this law that really would have completely suppressed the internet, dragging it down to the standard that still applies to broadcast media. By the way, you know, on the technology-specific standard, broadcast media are still held to this very low standard of protection. So when I'm talking about one of my favorite Supreme Court cases, another ACLU case, coincidentally, Cohen versus California, which involved the right to say, fuck the draft, at a time when the F word, I kid you not, was like the word that's the title of your book, Randy, I think, in terms of how loathed it then was. And, you know, it's such a taboo term. But the Supreme Court, you know, so it's a very important decision. You can't describe it without saying the word. But if I am discussing that case on TV, over-the-air TV, or radio, I still get bleeped and I get complaints. You know, you're endangering our broadcast license by saying that. The Clinton administration, so Congress voted overwhelmingly on both sides of the aisle to essentially treat the internet the same way it treats broadcast. The ACLU opposed that, and thank goodness. I mean, we would have been in a totally different world. So, yes, speech can be very harmful. The more powerful the means for conveying the speech, the more potential for harm, but also the more potential for good, right? And I think there's something about human nature, or at least the media, that tends to focus on the negative, right? Even in the old-fashioned media days, the mantra used to be, if it bleeds, it leads. So we hear a lot about speech that we don't like online, including social media. I can tell you, you know, whole social movements that many of us have been trying to activate for decades didn't take off until we had the power of online media, including social media. The ACLU had a campaign against police abuse, unjustified shootings, especially of dark-skinned young men, going back to the 80s. And I know there were protest movements going back even further than that, to the 50s and 60s. And that movement didn't start to gain traction until the images could go viral around the world. The movement against sexual harassment, my goodness, you know, Catherine McKinnon, even though I disagree with her on pornography, I think she performed a wonderful service in putting sexual harassment on the map, and that started in the 80s, but there wasn't a groundswell of women actually enforcing their rights until the Me Too movement came along, which was empowered by the new technology. So at some point, though, I agree with you, Randy, it probably is not empirically demonstrable. Mm-hmm. It probably is a matter of faith and presumption. I keep coming back to, and you've heard me say this before, good friend, I come back to Winston Churchill's famous aphorism about democracy. You know, it's the worst form of government except for all the others. And I think speech is incredibly dangerous, but it's, to me, demonstrably less dangerous than censorship, because censorship means investing government with the power to make subjective determinations about what speech is sufficiently potentially dangerous, right? Because by definition, if it satisfied the emergency standard, that would be a restriction I would support. And I simply distrust government even, and that's a completely nonpartisan statement. As you can see, the ACLU has litigated against government officials all across the ideological spectrum. I distrust the government more than I distrust my fellow and sister human beings. The marketplace of ideas is not perfect, but I think it's far less imperfect than government censorship. Now, let me tell you what I think is a tough, really, really tough question in the spirit that you raised, Randy. A few years ago, I had the opportunity to debate Vera Jourova, who is a top official with the European Union. I debated her in Brussels, and she's the one that's been spearheading all of the very severe restrictions on so-called hate speech that the EU countries are required to adopt. By the way, I hope you noticed that, and that's what I pointed out to her, that despite enormous restrictions that result in police arrests and prosecutions of people for saying things that are considered hateful or discriminatory against various minority groups, there have just been catastrophic outbreaks of discriminatory violence in Germany, France, Britain, all across the EU countries against Jews, against synagogues, against refugees, against Muslims, against immigrants. And so I pointed out to her that these very strict hate speech laws, very strictly enforced, clearly have not, you know, reduced the problem of discriminatory violence. And my conclusion from that is that these laws don't work. But guess what her conclusion is? We need more of these laws. And I talk to social scientists, and they say, there's so many variables, you probably can't prove it one way or the other.
I'm sure people want to jump in. I'm going to ask one more question in turn to the audience. And this is a question about our present moment. Because, you know, fights over freedom of expression are all around us. And in your piece, Even Anti-Semites Deserve Free Speech, you talk about one controversy on campuses. It's a controversy involving a situation in which some students who express their view with respect to the fighting in Palestine, Israel. There were some students who, after the attack in October, wrote an open letter. These students were identified, And at least in some instances, there were employers that rescinded offers of employment. Now, in your piece, you are very critical, extremely critical, of the statements of those students. And in fact, I'll just say, just parenthetically, it's been interesting. I've seldom seen you so worked up as in the last few weeks. I mean, I've heard you a couple of times, and you know, just reading. I mean, obviously, this is a burning issue. And in your remarks, or in your piece, you're very critical of those students. But even though you're critical of the students, you say that offers should not be withdrawn. Let me read a little bit of this. You say, employers have every legal and professional right not to hire those who support officially designated terrorist organizations. But then you say, but there are important countervailing considerations that weigh against imposing such adverse consequences for noxious expression. We should also consider the cultural effects of such retribution. People say ill-conceived, stupid, even evil things all the time. Should they all be cast out into the wilderness, their livelihoods jeopardized? If so, for how long? It seems unlikely that young people who find their careers prospects thwarted for expressing hateful views will be more likely to change their minds as a result of their public shaming. Employers and other powerful private actors, including social media platforms, should not impose disproportionately harsh punitive consequences for ugly speech. Now here's my question is, you talk about the general disutility of punishing the students. One thing you did not talk about, however, is what about the political, ideological sensibilities of the employer?
Yes.
Imagine a small firm that has made an offer to, you know, a third-year student, and then it comes to the attention of the firm that this third-year student is a fervent champion of, let's just say, the Proud Boys, and has said on, you know, in any number of tweets or whatever, I'm down with the Proud Boys, you know, hit them again. And then the firm rescinds the offer. My question is, as a legal matter, they clearly can. As a moral / political matter, is the firm in the wrong?
This is a very complicated question, and let me tell you, I'm going to add to your reading list. You've done wonderful research, but I think about a week ago I published a much longer piece in Time Magazine, which Time Magazine commissioned specifically. It arose from a quote I had in the New York Times that was commenting specifically on the Harvard situation, and the Time Magazine editor was fascinated. He said, could you elaborate on that? And I enlisted a co-author, the same one as I wrote that piece with, who is a social psychologist and from also is very concerned about what is an effective way to change people's views, to open their minds, you know, and in addition to my legal perspective about what's appropriate as a matter of law. And I have to tell you, Randy, don't think I've worked so hard, you know, per word as I have since I was on the Harvard Law Review, because we were really trying to work out this inherently judgmental matter, right, about cancel culture. This is what it comes down to. That, you know, what one thing we were absolutely clear about, and I see a lot of inconsistency, as I often do on free speech issues, is that on cancel culture, mostly until October 7th, had been criticized from the right, when it was people who were making insensitive comments about race or gender. And now it was people to the right of center who were really criticizing me even for that piece. How dare you say that these students should be given another chance? You know, this is just pure evil. And so it really forced us to articulate the factors that, and everything was very fact-specific and a matter of judgment, but what we advocated that employers should take into account. Again, they have a free speech right and other rights to do this, although I have to make a parenthetical nod to your co-author on an important piece, Eugene Volokh, who points out many people are not aware of this, and until I read his writings on point, I was as well. The federal anti-discrimination laws, which do outlaw discrimination by private sector employers on the basis of race, religion, and so forth, do not outlaw discrimination on the basis of political beliefs or expression. But quite a few state and local laws do outlaw discrimination on the basis of political views, and some of them have been interpreted broadly enough that Eugene contends that a law firm in some states could get into trouble under these laws for refusing to hire a student or an applicant or rescinding an offer. So I have to put that out there as a matter of professional responsibility. Beyond that, Pamela, my co-author, and I, and this I give her credit for this idea, she said we have to distinguish between particular cancellations, some of which may be justified and some of which may not be justified, and we lay out some of the factors. And on the other hand, a cancel culture, so that even if a particular cancellation might be justified, we want to be careful of avoiding a culture that is so punitive that it has an unduly speech suppressive impact on people who say, well, I'm not going to discuss these issues at all for fear that I might have my job offer rescinded. That's exactly what we're trying to oppose. And all things being equal, I'm an educator. I believe in restorative justice. I think, more important than me, we have a political system where restorative justice has been embraced across the political spectrum, even for people who have committed acts of violence, including homicide. You know, if we're going to have that kind of forgiving, constructive, rehabilitative approach for people who have engaged in violent conduct, a fortiori, as we lawyers say, can't we have that same kind of forgiving attitude, a pro-education attitude toward people who are simply advocating violence? Now, let me give you one example. You know, so we gave an example that we gave in the timepiece of a punishment that we thought would be unduly harsh goes back to Harvard, those 34 student organizations that had signed a petition. And so we said, rather than punishing every single student who's a member of those organizations, it would be better to use this as an opportunity to engage with them on an individual basis rather than this broad brush guilt by association. You know, did the individual student know of the statement? Did the individual student have an opportunity to comment on it after they saw the statement? What did they do? And so forth. An example we gave of speech that we thought could and should be punished, and I think it has not been. And again, I'm depending on, for the facts, on what I've read in the press, I understand it may not be accurate, but press accounts indicated that Wellesley College students who were employed by the college as resident assistants issued a condemnation, essentially, of any student who supported the state of Israel and basically said that they would not be able to provide their services as resident advisors to those students, that those students would have to go elsewhere. And we saw that as a clear dereliction of their duty as employees, while stressing that if they made those very same statements in their capacity as students who were engaging in general public discussions, that should be protected. So it's complicated.
Okay. Comments, questions, objections? Yes.
So we need to put them on the microphone just so that they catch the video. And while Brecken's running the microphone out, I should just mention that during the introduction, I failed to mention that we also want to thank the Harvard Alumni for Free Speech Group that has been part of helping us put this event together. And with that, we've reached the microphone for our first question.
So very recent, as a response to measures restricting free speech, we're seeing a new trend of state governments considering measures which essentially ban private actors from restricting free speech. The most notable example of this was before Elon Musk took over what we now know as X, there was a law being considered in Texas that essentially banned social media companies from banning certain types of content. So my question to you is on whether those kinds of laws, in your opinion, pose a certain conflict with the First Amendment, as well as other laws, let's say the laws which you mentioned, the ones that ban employers from firing employees based on their political opinions, whether that itself would create a First Amendment issue restricting an employer's right to.
Those are great questions, and thank you for recognizing that there are first free speech kinds of concerns on both sides here. And you probably know that the Supreme Court has granted cert on the Texas case and another one from Florida, in which the circuit courts went in diametrically opposite directions. But I agree with the judges who have ruled that it would violate the free speech rights of the private platforms to hamper them from engaging in their editorial discretion. I think we have to look for other mechanisms to encourage, to empower online speakers to be sure that they have adequate platforms. For example, interoperability so that platforms could be required to allow access by third-party software providers to provide whatever filtering mechanism the user seeks. That's right now what tentatively I support, but not government regulation.
Others, yes.
I have two questions. One of them is short. Directly for Dr. Strosen, and one for either of you. So the first one, I like this idea of restorative justice, particularly Jake the Proud Boys, who had particularly heinous speech. But how do you distinguish between rehabilitative justice in that instance versus the rehabilitative justice the Chinese impose on the leaders? Who gets to decide? So that's the first question. The second question for both of you is, I'm quite fond of this idea of the rights to hear. It gives you the ability to hear diverse ideas, to inform your own opinions. Does the right to hear also imply with it a right not to hear? And if so, what are the consequences of that? There may be a follow-up.
Okay, so Marshall, on the first question, I think you're giving me an opportunity to clarify, because I'm not suggesting compulsory indoctrination by the government, which I think would be the Uyghur situation. What I'm suggesting is that the private sector actor, rather than imposing like the equivalent of the death penalty, you're never going to work for me, take a more educative, constructive approach of maybe we can find a way to integrate you into our culture, which, by the way, going back to your point, there's also a freedom of association on the part of the institution. Do you want to take the second question?
Go.
I'm sorry, you might have. I thought you were going to answer it, so I...
How are we time-wise?
We'll have to wrap up by 1 point.
I'm so sorry. I have a plane to catch.
Okay, well, it seems to me that we've reached time. I want to have the last word here, actually.
Oh, it's almost 1:20.
Yeah, it is really 1:20.
I'd be happy to come back and do nothing but answer questions.
I want to just say, first of all, thanks to the Fellow Society. Thank you all for coming. And I do want to thank my colleague here. 2 weeks ago, the National
National
Coalition Against Censorship bestowed its lifetime award on Nadine Strossen, which was completely, completely warranted. And I just want to say personally how much I admire you, how much I've learned from you, and want to say on behalf of all of us, we're very grateful that you came. Thank you.
Thank you.